You are listening to Latin Waves, a weekly syndicated program. For more information about our program, visit www.latinwavesmedia.com. Latin Waves Media is also now available on Twitter at twitter.com/LatinWavesMedia. Online, I'm very privileged to have Ellen Hodgson Brown. She developed her research skills as an attorney practicing civil litigation in LA. In her latest book, Web of Debt, she turns those skills into an analysis of the Federal Reserve and the Money Trust. She shows how these private cartels have usurped the power to create money from the people themselves and how we, the people, can get it back. Welcome to the show, Ellen.
Thanks.
In your book, Web of Debt, you explain how, except for coins, all our money is created as loans, essentially out of thin air, in both Canada and the U.S., advanced by private banking institutions, including the privately owned Federal Reserve Bank. Banks create the principal, but not the interest to service the loans. To find the interest, new loans must be taken out, expanding the money supply and creating inflation. Now, my question to you is, if all the money is created out of debt, where is the money in the money supply to cover interest and the inflation?
It isn't in the money supply, so that's the point. That's why more and more people have to go into debt to support what is essentially a Ponzi scheme. This Ponzi scheme for the last 300 years has gone around the world until we managed to, the big banks managed to indebt third world countries, and now they've, having run out of other debtors, they've turned on the U.S. homeowners. And when they ran out of good borrowers, then they got into the subprime market, and they supposedly kept that going with this whole derivative scheme. And now, of course, all of that has collapsed. But basically what happens is banks make loans of money that didn't exist until they lent them. And many authorities have attested to this. The Federal Reserve itself says so, that when a bank makes a loan, it's new money created on the books of the bank. And then there's a reserve requirement where, back in 1907, when there was a major bank panic, banks weren't honoring each other's checks. That was back when dollars were backed by gold, and the banks didn't trust each other to have the gold, and so they weren't honoring each other's checks, and there was a huge credit freeze, just like there is right now. So the Federal Reserve set up the system where the banks had to hold back 10% of their deposit obligations, like people would deposit money or they would create loans as deposits, and all that is money owed by the bank. So those are liabilities for the bank, so they would have to hold 10% in a reserve account because it was found that people only came for their gold on average 10% of the time. That was discovered way back in the 17th century. So we're still on that model, even though we're no longer on the gold standard. So the banks are supposed to have this reserve of 10%. So you create money on your books, that the money becomes a deposit in the borrower's account. Then the borrower writes checks on it. The checks go out of the bank into another bank. Well, that check has to clear through this reserve pool that's usually held at the Federal Reserve, or you can keep actual cash in the bank. But anyway, it's cleared through that reserve pool. Then the bank has to fill the pool back up. So it fills the pool back up with depositors' money coming in from other depositors. But that money, it's like the cashier who steals from the till, thinking that he'll put the money back, he's going to go gamble with it, and he'll put the money back, and nobody will be the wiser. So you're basically stealing from the new depositors, pretending that was the money that you just lent, when in fact that's the depositor's money. So you've got two people with claims on the same money, and that's how the whole money multiplier expansion of the money supply happens. But the problem is, while the banks are creating this loan equals a deposit equals a check, they don't create the interest on the loans. And all money today is created in that way by banks. The only money the government creates are coins. And all they do is replace the old coins when they wear out, so they're not really adding to the money supply. So all the new money comes in from banks creating loans in this way, but they only create the principal, they don't create the interest. So more money is always owed back to the bank than they put out there, than they put into the system. And so where is that money going to come from? Somebody somewhere has to take out another loan, and that's why it's basically a Ponzi scheme, that you have this continual need to expand, in order to support the people at the top of the pyramid. You have to always be sucking new people in at the bottom.
What the tragedy is, Ellen, if their interest and inflation money doesn't exist in the money supply, naturally built into the system thousands of foreclosures, bankruptcies, and all kinds of undue suffering that's occurring. Now, you mentioned derivatives. A handful of banks created these derivatives into the trillions of hundreds of trillions of dollars. Now, when that market collapsed, of course, the taxpayer was on the hook for massive, largest bailouts in U.S. history. Has anything changed, you know, since the Obama administration and started with the Bush administration? Has anything changed in the banking system? And do you buy into this argument that these banks are too big to fail?
I would say they're too big to exist. We have antitrust laws that say they can't be that big, but they've managed to get a waiver of the antitrust laws. It's like, we're too big to actually follow the law, so you have to give us a waiver. So there are these six big banks that are basically taking over the whole banking system. I mean, they should have broken them up in this last banking reform bill, but they didn't. And there was an attempt to break them up, but it didn't pass. So now we have these mega giants that are out of control, certainly out of our control. But what I think is interesting, what I just wrote about, there's a potential 62 million homes that can't be foreclosed upon because of a glitch in the system called MERS, the Mortgage Electronic Registration Services. I don't know if you want to go into that, but the banks took so many shortcuts that they may have cut off their own claim to title to all these properties. There are cases holding that MERS breaks the chain of title, and therefore the banks that are trying to foreclose don't have title to those properties. If there were a major, like if the Supreme Court were to rule that, or there were a class action that were to win on that score, that would definitely bankrupt those banks. And I think that they would then be and should be nationalized, and that there should some sort of mortgage agency should be set up that would buy up all those mortgages and do some sort of fair deal with the people. Right now, they have no incentive to do any kind of workout, and in fact, they can't legally do a workout because they don't even know who owns these properties. It's a bunch; they're securitized. They're owned by a bunch of investors who keep changing hands.
So yeah, let's expand on this, because I did read your article. Very interesting. So the banks, Merck's is a system whereas the banks are not officially holding the title. Expand on that.
MERS is an electronic registration system that has circumvented the recording laws. Of counties have recording laws where you have to, if you have real estate, you have to go to the county recorder and record title. And if title changes, you're supposed to do a recording each time. In other words, if you assign title to someone else, if somebody else is holds the mortgage note, you have to record that. Record that assignment. So they managed to skip all those steps. Supposedly this is just to save money, which right there is a fraud on the local governments, because they're not getting their filing fees. But that's not really the reason they did it. But that alone, there have been lawsuits brought just to try to recover these millions and millions in filing fees that have been lost to the local governments. But anyway, what has happened is the lender would turn the note, or sign the note over to MERS, the Mortgage Electronic Registration Services, and they keep track, supposedly, in their database of who holds the note. But all these changes are not legally recorded, and nobody really knows who really holds the note. And in fact, it's with this whole securitization process, it's divided up so that many people own different slices of different pieces of real estate. Supposedly, that was the whole reason for putting MERS into place, was that it allowed this huge securitization shell game.
What advice would you give to a Canadian or U.S. consumer, homeowner, that has a foreclosure note? Should they leave their home, or should they just stay put and say this foreclosure is not a valid based on the banking?
They should definitely fight it. But one problem is, in California, it's a non-judicial foreclosure state, which means that the foreclosing party, the bank, doesn't even have to go to court. And so all they do is, you know, put the thing up for auction. And so if you want to fight it, you have to start a court case for declaratory relief or whatever, which means most people don't know how to do that. If they're in foreclosure, they're probably broke, and so they can't afford an attorney. So that's a major problem right there. But some legal aid agencies are fighting these cases. you know, I've heard of a class action that might be started, which would be quite earth-shaking, I think. Just to get the facts out there, the law is the law, and that's what the law is. If it's true that MERS breaks the chain of title, that's not just random. It breaks the chain of title for 62 million mortgages. That's a major deal.
So when are you going to open up that class action lawsuit then and save those mortgages is the question?
Well, there are rumblings of that, but I can't report on it yet. Yeah, but I think that would be a major development because, I mean, of course, you know the courts aren't going to give 62 million homeowners their homes free and clear if they didn't pay for them. But it certainly would give a lot of leverage to, let's say, a homeowner's lobby. Right now, the Wall Street banks are holding all the cards, and so they always win. They get their way in every form of legislation, even though they started this mess, and yet they're the ones getting bailed out, not the people, not the businesses. Businesses can't get credit lines anymore. The reason we're in this whole vicious cycle is there's not enough money out there. The banks' credit has frozen. The banks aren't lending. And you can't even really blame the local banks for that. It's the Wall Street banks. The local banks are being bought up. I talked to one banker who said the local bank he works for has not made a loan for 3 years. They can't make a new loan because the regulators are all over them. The capital requirements are quite stringent now. They can't sell their loans off their books like they used to investors. There aren't very many good borrowers out there because everybody's credit's so risky. So everything is frozen up. There's not enough money out there to buy new real estate, et cetera. What they need to do is get some more money into the system, which could be done. I mean, you could do it the old-fashioned way, the way Lincoln did it, by printing money, and I think that's what they should do. And that's certainly what many countries have done historically very successfully. My favorite model is the Commonwealth Bank of Australia. It was set up after that same 1890s banking collapse. The government decided that they had to do something. Actually, Canada, you know, did the same thing pretty much. But anyway, the Commonwealth Bank was set up as a publicly owned bank, and this alarmed the bankers, and so they wanted to make sure that they put one of their own in charge of it, so they got a banker appointed as governor. Well, this man, Dennison Miller, saw the potential of the bank and used his insider knowledge of how banking worked to actually do public service. So the other bankers said, well, you're going to need like $1 million in capital. That's their trump card. You know, you've got to borrow your capital from us, and so that'll put you in debt to us. But Dennison Miller said, no. He said, I'm going to start this bank with no capital because I know how banking works. I'm only going to lend the credit of the Australian people. We are going to fund everything we need on credit. And any bank could do that. Any state could do that. Any government could do that. Fund what they need on credit. In other words, you're really monetizing the labor and materials that you are about to produce. So you pay your workers, you pay your materials by you create an account, put money in it as a loan, pay out your workers and materials, build something, then the profits from the thing you built go back to pay off the loan. In New Zealand, they did that. It was the Reserve Bank of Australia did that and built on credit, the credit of New Zealand, housing, low-cost housing, and then the rents from the housing paid off the loan. So you're not hyperinflating the money supply. It's not like you're just putting money out there and it never comes back. What you're doing is putting the credit out there first, building something, and then the thing you built is the thing that's monetized, in other words, and it pays off the loan.
This is what money is supposed to do. It's supposed to be attached to goods and services, so the inflationary bubble doesn't explode, and inflation is kept under control when you are attaching goods and services to the money supply. So most people I talk to feel frustrated that governments and banks are not listening. They just want to keep this derivative, as you call, Ponzi scheme moving forward instead of doing some rational planning around the financial system. So what can people do to move this kind of agenda?
Well, what I'm pushing for in the U.S. is state-owned banks, because Congress at the federal level is deadlocked and there's not much hope of getting anything done up there. But the states don't have the power to just borrow and borrow like federal government. They have to balance their books, and like here in California, every year we have this major fight, and right now Governor Schwarzenegger is once again talking about paying workers with IOUs because they can't come to an agreement. The problem is there really is no good solution. They can't raise taxes more on people who are already overtaxed, and they can't cut services more. They've cut them to the bone. So the third alternative, the reason that they have this problem in the first place, is there's not enough credit out there. So the way to get credit out there is to set up a state-owned bank that would generate credit. And we have one model, which is the Bank of North Dakota. North Dakota is the only state in the union right now that has a budget surplus. They have the lowest unemployment rate in the country, and they have the lowest loan default rate in the country. So their Bank of North Dakota uses the capital of the state. It's set up as a DBA of the state, so it's North Dakota doing business as the Bank of North Dakota. So technically, all of the capital of the state is the capital of the bank. So they've got their capital requirement covered. That by law, all of the revenues of the state are deposited in the Bank of North Dakota. So they've got their deposits covered. They've got a huge amount of deposits coming in. And they can use ordinary banking principles. They don't have to do anything radical at all. They just apply ordinary banking principles to create credit to fund all the things that the state needs. I mean, they do consumer loans, although they don't do a lot of them. Mostly they partner with other banks and do public projects. Any state could do that. Get their credit back in their own state. Even like an EU member country could do it, even though the Lisbon Treaty says that they cannot borrow from their own central bank. It also says this shall not apply to other publicly owned banks, which will be treated just like private banks. So even Greece, they could set up a development bank of Athens or something and generate euros on their books. I mean, generate credit on their books in euros, which is the national currency, and pay workers, pay materials, build something, and pay off the loan with the profits that they make. Plus, if you're the government and you own the thing, you own the bank, you're essentially getting your project interest-free. And studies have shown that if you cut interest out, you reduce the cost of any public project by 30% to 50%. So they're getting things way cheaper than they were before. For instance, you could set up some sort of alternative energy plant that, if you had to borrow the money, would not be cost effective. But because, I mean, if you had to pay interest on it, but because you're getting it interest free, it suddenly becomes not only sustainable, but actually profitable.
No, it makes no sense to me, Ellen, how when there's a crisis, we always look to the people of these banks and these industries who are the people who caused it, and we look to them for solutions. And here in British Columbia, we have all these P3 projects that are private partnerships, and they get money from private lenders, which is much more expensive than simply the province or the federal government giving an interest, a very low interest rate. The public's beholden to private bankers for the projects. So I wanted to thank you for coming on the show this morning. How can people access your books and your writings?
My website is www.webofdebt.com. That's the name of my book, Web of Debt. And then I also have a publicbanking.com, that's public-banking.com, which is all the latest news on that. And then all my other books are on ellenbrown.com, or Amazon carries all my books.
Thanks again for joining us, and let's hope we can get some rational agenda like this to our politicians, because what's happening now certainly has not been working. So thanks again for joining us.
Okay, and thank you.
Bye now. In the time we have left, I'm going to play an awesome audio clip I found called Money is Debt, to hammer home the corrupt nature of our money system and the urgent need for financial reforms of the kind Ellen Brown just spoke about. For at the core of our economic, social, and environmental problems is the banking system that seems to be taken for granted as normal.
Our mortgage, our signed pledge of payment, backed by the assets we pledge to forfeit should we fail to pay, is the only thing of real value involved in the transaction. To anyone who believes we will honor our pledge, that loan agreement or mortgage is now a portable, exchangeable, and saleable piece of paper. It's an IOU. It represents value and is therefore a form of money. This money the borrower exchanges for the bank's so-called loan. Now, a loan in the real world means that the lender must have something to lend. If you need a hammer, my loaning you a promise to provide a hammer I don't have won't be a help. But in the artificial world of money, A bank's promise to pay money it doesn't have is allowed to be passed off as money, and we accept it as such. Once the borrower signs the pledge of debt, the bank then balances the transaction by creating, with a few keystrokes on a computer, a matching debt of the bank to the borrower. From the borrower's point of view, this becomes loan money in his or her account, and because the government allows this debt of the bank to the borrower to be converted to government fiat currency, everyone has to accept it as money. Again, the basic truth is very simple. Without the document the borrower signed, the banker would have nothing to lend. Have you ever wondered how everyone, governments, corporations, small businesses, families, can all be in debt at the same time and for such astronomical amounts? Have you ever questioned how there can be that much money out there to lend? Now you know, there isn't. Banks do not lend money. They simply create it from debt. And as debt is potentially unlimited, so is the supply of money. And, as it turns out, the opposite situation is also true. Isn't it astounding that despite the incredible wealth of resources, innovation, and productivity that surrounds us, almost all of us, from governments to companies to individuals, are heavily in debt to bankers? If only people would stop and think, how can that be? How can it be that the people who actually produce all the real wealth in the world are in debt to those who merely lend out the money that represents the wealth? Even more amazing is that once we realize that money really is debt, we realize that if there was no debt, there'd be no money. If this is news to you, you are not alone. Most people imagine that if all debts were paid off, the state of the economy would improve. It's certainly true on an individual level. Just as we have more money to spend when our loan payments are finished, we think that if everyone were out of debt, there would be more money to spend in general. But the truth is the exact opposite. There would be no money at all. There it is. We are totally dependent on continually renewed bank credit for there to be any money in existence. No loans, no money. Which is what happened during the Great Depression. The money supply shrank drastically as the supply of loans dried up. And that's not all. Banks create only the amount of the principal. They don't create the money to pay the interest. Where is that supposed to come from? The only place borrowers can go to obtain the money to pay interest is the general economy's overall money supply. But almost all that overall money supply has been created exactly the same way, as bank credit that has to be paid back with more than was created. So everywhere there are other borrowers in the same situation, frantically trying to obtain the money they need to pay back both principal and interest from a total money pool which contains only principal. It is clearly impossible for everyone to pay back the principal plus interest because the interest money doesn't exist. This can even be expressed by a simple mathematical formula. The big problem here is that for long-term loans such as mortgages and government debt, the total interest far exceeds the principal. So unless a lot of extra money is created to pay the interest, it means a very high proportion of foreclosures and a non-functioning economy. To maintain a functional society, the rate of foreclosure needs to be low. And so, to accomplish this, more and more new debt money has to be created to satisfy today's demands for money to service the previous debt. But of course, this just makes the total debt bigger, and that means more interest must ultimately be paid, resulting in an ever-escalating and inescapable spiral of mounting indebtedness. It is only the time lag between money's creation as new loans and its repayment that keeps the overall shortage of money from catching up and bankrupting the entire system. However, as the bank's insatiable credit monster gets bigger and bigger, the need to create more and more debt money to feed it becomes increasingly urgent. Why are interest rates so low? Why do we get unsolicited credit cards in the mail? Why is the U.S. government spending faster than ever? Could it be to stave off collapse of the entire monetary system? A rational person has to ask, can this really go on forever? Isn't a collapse inevitable? Money facilitates production and trade. As the money supply increases, money just becomes increasingly worthless unless the volume of production and trade in the real world grows by the same amount. Add to this the realization that when we hear that the economy is growing at 3% per year, it sounds like a constant rate, but it's not. This year's 3% represents more real goods and services than last year's 3% because it's 3% of the new total. Instead of a straight line, as is naturally visualized from the words, it is really an exponential curve getting steeper and steeper. The problem, of course, is that perpetual growth of the real economy requires perpetually escalating use of real-world resources and energy. More and more stuff has to go from natural resource to garbage every year, forever, just to keep this system from collapsing. What can we do about this downright scary situation? For one thing, we need a very different concept of money. It's time more people ask themselves and their governments four simple questions. Around the world, governments borrow money at interest from private banks. Government debt is a major component of total debt, and servicing that debt takes a big chunk of our taxes. Now, we know that banks simply create the money they lend, and that governments have given them permission to do this. So the first question is, why do governments choose to borrow money from private banks at interest when government could create all the interest-free money it needs itself? And the second big question is, why create money as debt at all? Why not create money that circulates permanently and doesn't have to be perpetually reborrowed in interest in order to exist? The third question, how can a money system that can only function with perpetually accelerating growth be used to build a sustainable economy? Isn't it logical that perpetually accelerating growth and sustainability are incompatible? And finally, what is it about our current system that makes it totally dependent on perpetual growth? What needs to be changed to allow the creation of a sustainable economy?
In closing, I'd like to quote economist Kenneth Boulding. Anyone who believes exponential growth can go on forever in a finite world is either a madman or an economist. See you next time. We have come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program produced and broadcast from the studios of CGSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. The program is available free of charge to campus and community stations across Canada and the U.S. For more information about our work or to support our efforts, please visit our website at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Bye for now.